Welcome to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you, pulls it apart, and weaves the facts back together in ways that are easy to understand. I'm your host, Anna Staber. This season, we're untangling immigration, and we've arrived at our final episode. Normally, I'd dedicate this hour to policy solutions, but that didn't feel right this time. Because more than 120 million human beings on this planet are displaced, driven from their homes by war, famine, or flooding. 43 million of them are refugees. That's more than the population of Canada. And it's double the number of refugees that existed on planet Earth 8 years ago. Ohioans can't stop these global events, can't stop the displacement of people across the planet. And Congress can't seem to get its act together, even as record numbers pour across our southern border. It's a mess, a crisis where solutions seem impossible. We wanted to focus this final episode of Untangled Immigration on what we can do, what Ohioans can do to help, even if our government never acts. And we're starting right in our own backyard. Community Refugee and Immigration Services, or CRIS, is a Central Ohio nonprofit that helps refugees settle into life here in Central Ohio. Angie Plummer is CRIS's executive director, and she joins me in studio now. Angie, welcome back to Untangled.
Thank you, Anna. It's nice to be here.
About one out of every 100 people on this planet have been driven from their homeland, and that's a higher proportion of displaced people than during World War II. And it's a number that keeps increasing year after year after year. What do you make of the growing migrant crisis across the planet?
Given those just astounding numbers, there's obviously a need for durable solutions.
Because it's not going away.
It's not going away. It's getting bigger, and we have such an opportunity to make a difference in the lives of all of these displaced, not all of them, but many of these displaced people. In fact, a very small percentage actually come to the United States as resettled refugees. But there are so many economic benefits to having refugees come here. You know, in addition to what you mentioned, there's an important humanitarian concern that these vast numbers of people need a place to call home and something that provides them some permanence.
Yeah, we heard about the treacherousness of living in a refugee camp in our first episode from Blaise Balaziz. They are not the kind of place you want to spend a life.
No, and I have had such a great fortune of seeing when people are given an opportunity to thrive, what they can make of their lives. And with refugees, it's often the longer view. It's their children who end up going to college, really advancing economically. There are a number of studies, including one from the Health and Human Services, the Federal Health and Human Services, that talk about the billions that refugees give back if you look at a 15-year period of time.
CRIS and organizations like it all across the country help resettle these refugees with, you know, language classes, technology classes, helping with housing, getting set up with like vehicles and work. But there are less of you than there were a decade ago, even though the crisis is getting bigger.
Yes, this highlights one of our biggest challenges. We shrank in number when Donald Trump was first elected, with the first Muslim ban that was eventually eliminated, but there was plenty of damage to the infrastructure for resettling refugees. And that's taken a long time to rebuild. And in the interim, we've had COVID to cope with. And so that kind of mechanism can't just restart and rebuild immediately. So there has been a lot of effort to rebuild and welcome more people, including, for example, the many Afghans who were evacuated. These were U.S. allies who, as we all saw in the news, were taken out of harrowing situations at the airport. And, you know, Columbus is pleased to have welcomed over 500 Afghans just during that evacuation period.
Yeah, you brought up a really important point that our president decides how many refugees the U.S. admits each year. So the power comes from a law created in 1980, and the number we let in has generally declined from about 200,000 to 60,000 a year. But Trump slashed that by two-thirds during his presidency. He admitted 30,000 refugees in 2019 and 18,000 in 2020. And whether you thought that was the right move or the wrong decision, it impacted organizations like CRIS. In 2017, a major resettlement agency called World Relief closed its Columbus location. What was it like for you, Angie, when World Relief Columbus closed?
Oh, it was horrible. These were our friends, our colleagues, some of whom work with us today, that we were able to hire. But it was devastating to see what they had built just to be destroyed, you know, pretty much overnight. People of very good will trying to help others get a good footing in our community, to watch that happen. What was equally devastating was to see the impact on families who were waiting for loved ones to come because that process was shut down. And I remember very vividly in January of 2017, a press conference, we were asked to bring some impacted families, and was a Somali woman who typically would stay out of the limelight, but was in front of all of the local TV cameras and was asked by the reporter, well, what message would you like to give to the president? And she said, I would just ask him to help us. We just want to live with our children and our spouses. And at that time, she really had a belief this couldn't be happening in our country, that this wasn't a country that would allow for people to be kept apart based on their religion or their country of origin.
Yeah, I mean, going from 200,000 refugees per year to 18,000, that's a huge drop over the last couple of decades.
Yes, and I've been around for a while and have seen bipartisan administrations support the refugee program. It was very much a bipartisan program for many, many, many years until the Trump administration. There were ebbs and flows, certainly years of higher arrivals and lower, but as you noted, Anna, the presidential determination is what the president decides every year at the beginning of the fiscal year, how many can be let in.
If any at all. There's no obligation to admit a single person.
If any at all.
Yeah. During that time, World Relief was actually a nationwide nonprofit with local offices. They laid off 20% of their U.S. staff and closed local offices in four other cities like Nashville, Miami, and Boise. President Joe Biden has reversed those policies when he took office. Now, there was a pandemic, which also kept all forms of immigration low. How did you guys have to scramble to meet the new demands, right? Because it was low for a number of years, and then it sort of has gone back up.
Yes, we had significant growth pretty much overnight, which comes with its own bumps and bruises. But I feel very fortunate to work with people who are so dedicated to helping others that they go the extra mile. And we've asked a lot of our staff to try to meet that demand as we try to rebuild our infrastructure. So it's not been easy, but it's a labor of love.
Are you preparing for this election and the potential that the numbers are going to drop back down?
Yes, it's certainly on my mind quite a bit.
How important do you think the presidential election is when it comes to immigration? Because there's always that question of how much influence a president actually has over things like the economy and whether they should deserve credit for a good economy or blame for a bad economy. But when it comes to immigration, it seems as though the president holds a lot of cards.
Yes, the executive branch really is in control. And so much of the resettlement program is the State Department. So that's part of the executive branch. And as you noted, if the president sets the ceiling at zero, then that decimates the program. So the
election... And it puts you guys out of a job.
Yes. The election is an existential issue for us.
Another issue seems to be fundraising. So last year, Texas's, that's a weird possessive, Texas's largest resettlement agency announced it was shutting down. Refugee Services of Texas said it could no longer raise enough money to stay open. Now, there were some questions about how they were spending their money. But what is the fundraising landscape for resettlement organizations in this country?
So it's expected that it's a public-private partnership. And so the government doesn't supply all of the funding needed to run the program. So we are regularly trying to raise funds so that we can do that private part of the partnership. The federal government does a pass-through to us per capita for each refugee we resettle. And we host events. We have, in the past, when we had our last existential issue, had a 100K in 100 days fundraiser, and was so proud that, yes, we did receive some sizable donations, but most of it was smaller donations from many, many people who wanted to be supportive of the program. There's a report that is coming out soon called Immigrants Make Columbus, and the final report hasn't been released, but it talks about one of the big takeaways is how a sense of belonging is essential for people to thrive, and how important it is for us. That's one way. I remember hearing a woman say, the best thing my sponsor ever gave me was her phone number. So yes, it's, you know, we always welcome financial donations, but volunteers who become engaged with refugee families so that those families feel more a part of our community, that's good for everyone. They may start your next favorite restaurant.
That's a good point. What are your immediate volunteer needs right now?
We, a welcome team is a really great way to get involved.
What's a welcome team?
A welcome team is a group of people. We have something called an arrival team or a welcome team. Welcome teams are more formal, do have a financial commitment to help pay for some rent for arriving refugees. An arrival team might meet a family at the airport, provide the first dinner, and then help with some transportation. It, you know, it depends on the group's ability and their capacity. We have a need for mentors for our youth mentorship program. So that's another good way for people to get, you know, hands-on involved. But really, it's embracing somebody's interest and skill set. You know, if you're a good writer, we might have an ability for you to help us, you know, write stories of refugees for our social media, or just depending on one's interest.
Or work with them on English language learning.
You know, tutors, English language tutors are in high demand too.
Yeah. Do you take donations of physical items?
Yes, we welcome especially household items, pots and pans. Refugees receive a one-time pass-through grant of $1,325 per person. That's one time. That has to be spent towards rent and all their household items. So to the extent we get donations, they don't have to use that limited amount of money. They can use it towards rent instead of buying towels and sheets. And so all those kinds of, and there's wonderful lists on our website that spell out like what kinds of things that we take.
What you don't take, what condition they should be in.
We typically don't take clothing because often it's not culturally similar to people who are arriving, except winter coats and hats and gloves, those kinds of things we do take.
That makes sense because a lot of times people are coming from places where winter isn't much of a thing.
Right. I remember vividly seeing some Nepali women wearing flip-flops in the winter. So we try to get them accustomed to shoes.
Oh my goodness, they must have been cold.
Yes.
What is the most important thing that you think Central Ohioans can do to help settle refugees here in Central Ohio?
Just get engaged, you know, help spread that feeling of welcome. You can be engaged by donating financially, but really it's being a part of a community. And in the best way to do that, I think, is meeting someone. And whether it's, you know, your child has a new friend at school and maybe you invite that family over for dinner, you get involved with the Refugee Resettlement Agency. There are three of us in town who very much welcome volunteers and have a structured program to orient folks and get people engaged. And certainly we can use financial resources. Some of that, we get a lot of requests for help for rent and utilities and those kinds of things. So that helps, you know, we do direct client assistance, but also helps us operate.
Yeah, because I was going to say, you also work with asylum seekers and they have a 6-month ban on working upon arrival.
Yes, it's really difficult for asylum seekers. That inability to work right away really puts them at the mercy of the goodwill of others.
That was Angie Plummer, Executive Director for Ohio's Community Refugee and Immigration Services. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Anna.
Coming up, we're sharing what a Columbus City Council member and a national expert on immigration say about what we can do with the crisis at hand. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're ending our series on immigration this hour, and joining me now to talk about solutions is Columbus City Councilmember Lourdes Barroso de Padilla. She's a first-generation American, the daughter of refugees, and the first Latina to be elected to City Council. Welcome to Untangled.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Columbus hasn't been overwhelmed by migrants from the southern border in the past year. Cities like New York, Denver, Chicago have borne the brunt of that. Still, more than 9,000 immigrants gave a Columbus address in their immigration court proceedings last year, which was a 350% jump from 2019. Mm-hmm. So we are seeing an increase, just not as dramatic as other cities. How is Columbus adapting?
Well, it's interesting. I think as we look at our growth and we are talking about, you know, projections of, you know, anywhere between doubling to tripling our growth, our population size by 2050. And we think that's going to happen faster than 2050. But the number one factor is immigrants, migrants, and refugees. And there's a number of factors. We have an infrastructure that supports it. I mean, you spoke to one of our amazing organizations that helps folks get resettled here. We have an economy that allows for prosperity for folks. And we already have a bit of a stronghold, right? Both the Latino community, the African diaspora, the Asian diaspora. And so we know that most people come to places like my parents did because they know someone, right? And so when you know someone, you have kind of a built-in community kind of infrastructure that supports you relocating to wherever you're going to go.
Yeah, you have people who speak your language. You have people that understand your culture. You have restaurants that serve the food you grew up with.
Grocery stores, right? Churches, cultural centers that see you. And that's why we will continue to see an influx of people coming to Columbus. And I think that it's interesting because I think we have systems in place that we can measure our growth, but you always know, similar to what happened in Colonial Village, where we had an influx of folks from the Haitian community that came to Columbus that was under our radar for a while, right?
Oh, until my goodness, yes.
Until we saw it. And we're seeing that happen in other parts of the community. So I think that while we have some social indicators like, you know, the court system, like, you know, the census, we know that that does not always give us an accurate picture of what's really happening in the community.
How do you think diversity will play a role in the future of Columbus?
I mean, I think that it's not just about what's happening in Columbus. It's what's happening across the world. The world is getting smaller and smaller, and it has been for a long time. And with the accessibility of things that connect us, like the internet, the accessibility to travel, giving people more access to be able to move around the world, we're just getting more and more diverse. And a place like Columbus that is growing, it's growing because of its diversity. It's growing because of the opportunities that we have here. And so that means that we need to change how we create systems, change the systems that we have in place, change how we think, and make the community more accessible for the people who live here and continue to choose Columbus.
So how do we do that?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. We, you know, since I came into office, given my background, immigrants, migrants, and refugees are something that are very, that community is very close to my heart. I think as a first-gen kid, you live a very parallel experience. Even though I did not have the same experience of coming to this country, I think all of the aspects of living in this country and the gaps in knowledge and cultural understanding and access were certainly something that I experienced. And so when I came into office, I really had a commitment to these communities. And so we just announced that we'll have the first immigrant and refugee commission for the city of Columbus that will really act as a body that advises not just city council and or the mayor's office, but really the city as a whole, can really help to inform some of our decision making and help us be more proximate to communities. So we talked about Colonial Village and the influx of Haitians into our community. That's a way that we can keep our fingers on the pulse of what is happening. And then within our local jurisdiction, allow for supports for families and for people who are choosing to make Columbus home, no matter what their status is.
And a lot of what you do or don't do so often in the city of Columbus is tied to what the state allows you to do, what the federal government allows you to do. And, you know, Ohio gives licenses, driver's licenses, to green card holders, refugees, those on student or work visas. We also allow asylum seekers to apply once they've gotten certain paperwork completed with the immigration court in Cleveland. But there are about 90,000 people living in the state of Ohio who cannot access a driver's license. And I know transportation is pretty important to you as a topic. Where do you come down on that issue? Because I suspect some of those folks are driving.
Sure. Well, there's a couple things. First of all, I think it's about when we look at systems change, we have to think about accessibility. And one thing that we are investing in is LinkUS. LinkUS is our bus rapid.
We're going to be voting on that in November.
That's correct. And it is a ballot measure for COTA. So folks should not look for LinkUS. They should look for a COTA ballot measure that will allow us to provide. We're the only city of our size across the country that does not have a mass transportation system that meets the needs of our community. And so bus rapid transit is what we have chosen to solve that. And we're doing that because we don't quite have the density for light rail. And I know folks are anxious for light rail. Maybe in 10 years we can look at light rail. But right now, bus rapid transit is a way that we want to ensure that we're allowing folks to have that accessibility to transportation, right? So it takes about $12,000 a year to maintain a good car. So giving folks the option of riding a transit system with 5 lines, by the way, that crosses all across the city, this helps them. They could live on a line where that line will have all of the amenities that they need, like medical and, you know.
This is tied to the zone in, too.
Exactly. How we're changing our zoning code to allow for more development to come in more quickly. And so that's one way that we are changing the system to meet the needs of the people.
Taking away the temptation to drive.
That's correct.
Or potentially even the need.
The need. Really, it's more about the need. It's not so much the temptation. The temptation is there out of necessity, right?
Yeah.
It's not there because it's like a fun thing to do. It's like, that's how I get across town. And so by giving folks not just a bus, but also an infrastructure to safely ride a bike or safely walk, that is ensuring that folks are getting to the amenities and the basic things that they need to live.
Do you, the city council, or are you guys considering at all any kind of funding or assistance for some of these resettlement organizations, from some of the rental assistance?
Oh, we have. Yeah. We've already been doing that. And that's something, you know, it's interesting because back when, and I want to be clear, a broken transport or broken immigration system is not a Democrat or a Republican issue, right? And we can't fix it. That is an American issue, right? That is a systemic issue that we need to address as a country. What we can do locally is allow protections for our people. So, for example, during the Trump presidency, we made it when we were facing some mass deportations, we made it so that at the city of Columbus, we could not ask anyone for their status We did that as a protection, right? So if you're looking for seeking a city service and you live here and you pay taxes, we are not going to ask you what your status is. Again, that was to protect our people. We've changed the things that we can change within our abilities to, again, protect people. So allowing for the resettlement of the folks who were in Colonial Village, so they could find a place to live, because many of these folks, they needed that shelter, right? Why they were working through their paperwork to get their citizenship. And we know, especially for Haitians, it's very complicated. And what their status is much more complicated than even this show could probably untangle, right? but I think that's what we are looking at. We are looking at how do we protect our people and our families who choose Columbus and live here, and ensure that we have strategies to make sure that they can move, that they can be employed, and that they can find shelter.
Final question for you. How important is the presidential election to immigration, in your opinion?
I think it's key. I think that, whoever is our president affects policies that are much bigger than us, right? We can certainly protect the things that you see out your window as local politicians, but those big, how does it affect a quality of life, especially for some of the folks who are most vulnerable in our communities? That's something that we need to look at. And again, I will say the way I started, this is not just a Republican or a Democratic issue. The strategies are what we need to pay attention to. But we're already seeing signals of how folks will come down, again, on some of the most vulnerable people in our communities. And this goes way past a narrative that we put out about one or two people. This is what we are overlaying, a narrative that we're overlaying over a good swath of the people who this country was founded for. This country was founded so that people could seek liberty and justice and freedom. And we are moving so far away from the core values of what this experiment that is called America was for. And I think that people need to see people. They need to be proximate to communities. They need to understand the issues and go beyond a one-dimensional narrative of who is choosing to make America home.
That was Columbus City Councilmember Lourdes Barroso de Padilla. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you for having me.
I want to shift our conversation to presidential power and the power we all have this November in deciding who our next president will be. Because the Constitution gives our president a lot of latitude when it comes to immigration. As we said earlier, presidents decide how many refugees we resettle each year. Presidents can close the borders or restrict entry like we did during the pandemic. And presidents get to decide how immigration laws get enforced. Joining me now to talk about it is David Beer, Director of Immigration Studies for the Cato Institute. David is an expert on immigration, border security, and interior enforcement. Welcome to Untangled.
Thanks for having me on.
One of the things we've talked about on all sides is whether presidents really deserve the credit or the blame for things like the economy. But when it comes to immigration, the executive branch has so much power. How much of our immigration policy hinges on who is our next president?
That's an excellent question. If you look at the big picture, so much of it is still controlled by Congress, because Congress sets the caps on the number of green cards that can be issued each year and sets the categories under which you can even apply for a green card. And a green card is legal permanent resident status and the opportunity to apply for citizenship after 5 years. Without a green card, you're just basically up to the executive whim. You're here temporarily, or the executive branch is allowing you to stay. And so Congress really does control most of immigration policy from that standpoint. If there's no way to permanent status, if there's no green card opportunity for you, then you're really, you're really beholden to whoever is in office. And there's not a way for you to assert your rights against an adversarial executive branch that doesn't want you there. And so from that standpoint, it's really largely controlled by Congress. How the enforcement apparatus targets people and removes them from the country, and that whole process, there is a whole range of possibilities about how that's unleashed. Look, the Biden administration is forcibly removing more people from U.S. soil than the Trump administration ever did. I mean, it's incredible the number of people that they've removed, but they have targeted the enforcement apparatus almost entirely to the people who have recently crossed the border, people who are arrested by Border Patrol, and away from people who've been living in the United States for a while in the interior of the country. And so that's the kind of decision making that, you can see a huge difference in from that standpoint from one administration to the next. And so that's, I think there's a range of possibilities. Of course, there's a lot of enforcement discretion. I think obviously the Biden administration is rapidly increasing the amount of restrictions on asylum. It didn't need to do that. It could have gone a different way in its approach there. But that shows how even within an administration, you can have a huge change in enforcement policy about how people enter and are removed from this country.
We're not going to talk about comprehensive immigration reform this hour because it doesn't feel like a viable solution, at least not in this Congress and potentially not in the next one. I did want to talk, though, about guest worker visas because this would be a smaller, more moderate reform. We talked to a farmer from Waverly, Ohio, earlier in the series who hires temporary agricultural workers to harvest his crops. He hires a group of guys from Mexico. He brings them back every year. And Cameron told me he hires them because he can't find Ohioans who want the jobs, which is a whole other conversation. What I'd like you to explain is the correlation between guest worker programs and illegal border crossings.
Historically, there's a huge and important relationship between these two processes. The guest worker visas have a legal way for people to come, and obviously the alternative is to cross the border illegally. And you go all the way back. I mean, guest worker programs started really in World War I was our first iteration of this concept where Mexicans would enter under a temporary status, work for farms, and then go home. And that expectation was then eliminated. They eliminated the program. And then it was reborn again during World War II, when you had all these farmer workers go off to war. We needed farm hands, so we brought in Mexicans from through the Bracero guest worker program. And that increased dramatically through the 1950s and into the 1960s. We saw a huge decline in the number of people crossing illegally after its expansion, particularly under the Eisenhower administration. During the late 1950s and early 1960s, we had almost eliminated illegal immigration from Mexico. And really, illegal immigration and Mexican immigration were almost synonymous at that time because the costs of getting to the border were so much higher for people from Central America and South America. And so this relationship was, the expansion of the guest worker program alongside expansions in enforcement. They hired more Border Patrol agents, they enforced more vigorously. But the key fact was farmers knew they could hire people legally, so there's no reason to go through the illegal process or hire people without papers. And the same was true on the other side of the border for these Mexican farm workers. That ultimately was eliminated in 1965 for the 1966 summer. And there was widespread expectation in Mexico, look, we're not going to cross the border illegally in 1966 because this program might come back. We don't want to lose our chance to come legally. Then it became clear later on in the 1960s, Congress isn't re resurrecting this program. The administration isn't creating a new program. And so from the late 1960s and into the 2000s, we had huge numbers of people coming illegally because this process of guest worker visas were eliminated. In the late 1990s, you started to see the expansion of the H-2A and H-2B guest worker programs, which are very similar in some sense to the Bracero program. You come in temporarily, you work for a specific employer.
Less than
and
a year.
Go home. Yes, it's only available to jobs that last less than a year. So the key requirement is it's seasonal or it's temporary duration. And so you have to go home at the end of the year, unless, you know, there's some exceptions. If you find another temporary job with another employer, you can go to that. But for the most part, it's seasonal. People are going home every year. And again, it's primarily Mexican immigrants. A lot of reasons for this, but employers will hire Mexicans because they're closer. So they can get on a bus. You don't have to fly them in. You know, there are already recruiters in Mexico who can find the workers for you. And then, of course, you know, once you hire some workers you like, you keep hiring them. And so we saw substantial declines in the rate of illegal immigration in starting in the late 1990s and into the 2010s as a result of this expansion of guest worker visas. Also, more enforcement helped, you know, provide an incentive for people to use those programs. But certainly there was a huge trade-off. It eroded somewhat. The enforcement side let up a little bit during the pandemic. A lot of people don't realize that part of it. The Trump administration actually pulled back from some of the enforcement policies, particularly prosecutions of people for crossing the border illegally were relaxed during the pandemic. And that led to more Mexicans crossing illegally, but that is not, did not go back to the levels it was previously, in large part because these work visas were available to people. And so Mexican illegal immigration is higher than it was, but not nearly as high as it would be if we didn't have these work visa programs available to them.
Central Americans receive about 3% of the share of these guest worker visas. Is it safe to say, in your opinion, that if we opened up more of these temporary visas for Central Americans, we could see a decline in illegal crossings?
Absolutely. You know, this is the biggest problem is that, you know, we don't have employers going to these other countries. Mexico, obviously, is a huge labor market. If you're going to adopt the model of the employer gets to pick whichever workers come, you need to have some incentive for them to pick from a more diverse set of countries when more diverse sets of immigrants are arriving at the border. So for historical reasons, they've been mainly recruiting from Mexico. The only way you're going to have Central Americans get a portion of that is if you get give employers a reason to go there. And so
like a subsidy for their plane ticket.
Well, you could do a subsidy, but really, I mean, the big issue for the H-2B guest worker visa is that it's capped. Mm. And so there's a hard limit to the number of visas that can be issued in a year. And so say give them a cap exemption and say if you recruit from Central America, you're not going to be subject to the cap. And then you can bring in workers from that part of the world in order to allow them to come in legally, knowing, of course, that many of them would have otherwise come to the border illegally and contributed to the problems there. And so that's the trade-off that we need to focus on. We saw a little bit of this, a small portion of this actually implemented under the Biden administration. They have created a small carve-out for Central American and Haitian nationals to be able to use these guest worker programs, but it's really small if you look at it compared to the flows coming to the border. You know, you need a really robust number. I went down in December of last year in order to, you know, assess what's happening with this whole situation, these guest worker visas being issued to Salvadorans. And you hear their stories and they're like, I was considering coming illegally until I had this opportunity to get a visa. And now I would never consider, I mean, the benefits of coming legally are so great. And the first time I heard about it, I thought it was a myth. I thought it was a scam. I thought it was a lie because I never heard of anyone coming with a visa. Not for someone like me who, you know, didn't know anyone in the US and didn't have or at least knowing it with legal status in the United States. And so that to me is the thing that should really open the eyes of people within the administration and Congress and policymakers to the benefits of this is people don't have the impression that legal immigration is even an option to them. And so they're not hanging around waiting to see, okay, what's the visa number is going to be, because they think, you know, when they hear about the opportunity to come legally, they think it's their first thought is, this is a scam. Someone's trying to get money out of me, and this isn't going to work out. Fortunately, some people have tried it out and seen that it does work. But the broad impression is, you know, it's still like winning the lottery. It's not something that's reliable. It's not something that you should bet, you know, your life on, in many cases, for these people who desperately need to find some other way to support their families.
That was David Beer, Director of Immigration Studies for the Cato Institute. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're talking with an Ohio State professor who has been working for the last 30 years to change the conversation around immigration. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you. I'm your host, Anna Staver. This season, we've been untangling immigration from an Ohio perspective, something Jeffrey Cohen has been studying for the last 30 years. He's an anthropology professor at Ohio State University who studies the impact and outcome of migration from indigenous communities. And he joins me now in studio, fresh off the plane from Mexico City, where he attended an annual migration conference. Welcome to Untangled, Professor Cohen.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So one of the conference's main themes was bringing human rights into the conversation around migration. How do we go about doing that?
It's a tough, it's a large order. And it's an important one. It's perhaps the most important one, which is to bring dignity to the whole process, not just for movers, not just for refugees or migrants, but for the communities that they're entering as well. And it's there's a lot of things to do.
Do you worry that the conversation around immigration, particularly immigrants as criminals, is one of the narratives that we're hearing in this presidential election? Do you worry that that kind of conversation could become a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Well, I think in many ways it actually already has, because it's really penetrated the discussions that we're having, and it's moving us away from talking about the issues of, say, human rights. This is part of the larger framework there. So understanding that migrants, refugees, asylees are first people just like any of us is part of the process of moving beyond that discussion that says they are either legal, illegal, semi-legal, which is a discussion that really is very self-fulfilling if you think about it.
You know, I think as Americans or as Ohioans, it's hard for us to imagine war ripping through our country. You know, the Civil War was more than 160 years ago. Canada isn't exactly our adversary. We're isolated in a way that many countries are not. And I think sometimes it makes it hard to conceptualize, like, what it would take for me to flee my home with only what I could carry.
Yeah, that's an important point. The movement of folks into a place like the United States is not really one of, oh, I see money, let's go get it. It's really, I'm fleeing a situation that is so bad that staying is no longer an option. And so in a great deal of the research that I do and I do with colleagues, we focus specifically on dimensions of security for migrants, for refugees, for asylees, and the kinds of decisions that they have to make, which tend to be incredibly hard. It's very expensive to migrate. It's very expensive to leave your home. It's not just costly in economic terms. It's costly in in psychological terms. It's costly in personal terms. It's costly in family terms. So these are massively difficult decisions, and they're not made lightly, and they shouldn't be treated lightly, and they shouldn't be treated as simply one-dimensional and in response to, say, one piece of a puzzle. They're environmental, they're social, they're political, they're personal. And all of these things need to be taken into account as we try to explain what's happening.
You've spent decades talking with communities, particularly in Mexico, about why people leave, why they cross, what it does to the communities. And one of the things I found most fascinating is that a lot of them would go back and forth if they could, if they had that option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we describe the migration between Mexico and the United States, and this works for really so many regions of the globe, as a transnational process. That is, it's not one directional. It's not going from a home in Mexico to a place in the United States with the sense that you're never going to go back, but rather the movement back and forth where you're doing things actually on both ends of this process that are enriching and engaging with your community, with your family, and so forth. So maybe you're going to move once for schooling, you might do it another time for your children's schooling. And in fact, one of the most important things that we've learned is how many decisions are made, not for the individual, but for the family behind the individual.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating because you think, oh, okay, they've crossed the border. They want to stay here forever. They want to become U.S. citizens. But a lot of them would like to go home.
Mm-hmm. So
now, war makes that impossible in some situations, but...
Right. In some situations, war is going to make that impossible. In other situations, just other kinds of violence are going to make that impossible. Environmental catastrophe can make that impossible. But in the majority of the migrants that we've talked with, there's a sense that going home would be great. I mean, even you know, and one of the things that it's very important to remember is that even the story of the United States, which is a story of immigration, there's still a lot of people that have gone home. And easing that process, making that process accessible, is not a bad thing because it facilitates that movement. And it keeps things above board as well. Part of the challenge for Central Americans, Mexicans, people from the Caribbean, Haitians, for example, one of the challenges is the challenge of going home and the kinds of dangers that that are created on the return by people who are, you know, doing fairly egregious things to returning migrants.
So we started this hour by just talking about the sheer number of displaced people on the planet. One in 100 people, one out of every 100 people is displaced from their homeland. And part of the reason we did this project, this series on immigration, was because we've seen a massive increase in the number of people crossing our southern border. Is this the new normal? Is this just the state of the world as it exists in this moment?
It may be the new normal. That doesn't mean we can't change it. And I'd like to kind of echo Councilwoman Barroso's statement. These are not Democratic or Republican sorts of issues. These are not issues of that are one-dimensional. These are multidimensional issues. And if we address them from a position of dignity, and we address them from a position of humanistic sort of care, that champions social justice in the place of just trying to criminalize or demonize movers, I think we can actually arrive at solutions. I don't think they're that hard to find, but what's hard is the energy to put into it.
The will,
yes,
is
the
hard
will.
To
exactly.
Find the way.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, my final question that I've been asking everybody is, how critical do you see this election to the future of immigration in Ohio, in the country?
Mm-hmm. I probably every election is really critical. This election is perhaps more critical just because the debate around immigration, around asylum, around refugees has really gone off the rails in ways that I don't think we've seen it happen perhaps in the past. So many of us are the children or the grandchildren, maybe the great-grandchildren of immigrants, and the stories that our families brought with them that really inform who we are is something that really can continue to inform how we address this problem. One of the most important things that we can do is let people lead dignified lives, whether they're from the United, whether they were born here or they've come here. One of the best ways we can reach that place is by allowing people to pursue their dreams and not have to hide in the shadows. Because when people hide in the shadows, it's bad for everybody. Everybody loses, and we want everybody to win.
That was Jeffrey Cohen, an anthropology professor at Ohio State University who studies migration. I want to end this series with the words of Asha Abdullah, whose family are Somali refugees.
One of the most challenging things for them was they had graduated from college. They met at college. They were teaching back at their alma mater. They had gotten married. They had their first child. And it's one of those things where it's like they're kind of starting life, right? And you hear of things happening, but when you hear something like that, you never really think it's going to happen because it sounds like far-fetched. And the only thing I can compare it to is like the trailer for like some of those like dystopian movies or like even like that most recent movie like Civil War. If someone were to say something like that was happening, most of us would laugh and be like, sure thing, okay. Like, if you hear something like that, you're going to think it's never going to happen to me. So when they heard of something like that possibly happening or just like people having squabbles or whatever, they never thought it would actually happen to them at the Capitol. So when things started getting like more intense, they're like, you know what, just to kind of give our family peace of mind, let's just kind of grab a couple of items. We're going to go spend some time with my family. And that's kind of like what my dad said. So they grabbed a couple of items, maybe some clothing, but no one thought to grab like everything. And it's just one of those things where it was really heartbreaking to kind of hear them describe that because you wouldn't think to grab family photos or your diploma or like.
Oh my goodness, they didn't know they were leaving for the last time.
Exactly. Or like your newborn's like, or your like first child's like their first shoes or like their first outfit or what, like just those little knickknacks, right?
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't think of that.
You know, I want to ask, as you know, immigration, part of the reason I wanted to do this topic, cover immigration, mm-hmm. is because, you know, these days it can kind of feel like a four-letter word. It's so politicized. Mm-hmm. People have such strong opinions about it one way or the other. Mm-hmm. What's it like mm-hmm. living as an immigrant in Ohio in this moment, in this election?
It's one of those really difficult and challenging experiences because I can understand people wanting to have a better life and willing to having that urge to do anything they need to do because you wouldn't leave what you're familiar with if you felt like you had a different choice. But it's also one of those things where I think a lot of times it comes from a place of fear, that fear of the unknown, fear of what people are not familiar with that leads to this concern or this automatic, well, all these things are not going right. So is this the face or is this the reason why it's not going right? So it's very polarizing and it's one of those very challenging things where it's like at one point were we not all immigrants? Were we all not new somewhere? Were we all not looking for better opportunities? And it's one of those very challenging things where I fully understand to some degree where both sides are coming from, but it's also trying to find that middle ground of how do we have these conversations while also respecting each other's humanity and keeping it civilized.